Hi, welcome to the Spotlight Report. I'm your host, Logan Graves. This is a monthly podcast where we dive into topics that pique our interest. They typically cover optics and science, but honestly, they can be quite broad. You can find out more about the Spotlight Report and find all of our episodes, as well as comment or like the podcast, on our new location, which is on the ELE Optics Community Forum. That location is community.eleoptics.com, and you'll find the Spotlight Report there. Thanks for listening.
So it started with, hi, this is a Spotlight Report?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, I am here with Dr. Eva Acosta from the University of Santiago de Compostela. Dr. Acosta, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. We are connected via Daewoo Kim. So your work is primarily in visual optics, and we're going to get into that, but can you just tell me how you got into optics in general?
Well, my background is in physics. I make theoretical physics. But when I ended the graduate studies, I was in love with laser applications in medicine. So I entered in the optics department, where they put me directly in theoretical field of telecommunication. Mm. So, but anyway, I love that. So I worked during a long time in optical communications. And in fact, I made my postdoc in Japan in optical communications.
Okay.
And then after my postdoc, when I come back to Spain, well, two postdocs, after my postdocs, I came back to Spain.
Two postdocs.
Two postdocs. I came back to Spain. I began to make wavefront sensing.
Mm-hmm.
So, because of some political reasons, you know, in the departments, I could not follow what I learned in Japan. So I have to quit somehow all that research. And as I knew how to fabricate micro lenses for optical communications, I began to fabricate micro lenses for Shack-Harman sensors.
Yeah.
And at that time, with some colleagues in the in my department, the beginning we were more towards astronomical applications for telescopes. So that's what I did. And slowly, we were into vision, you know, because there is also like a parallel research in astronomy and invisual optics, especially all aberrations related with the eye, because they change of time, you can correct with the Harman sensor and all these things. So we went more to visual optics, and nowadays I'm just working in visual optics.
Right. So you were able to, over time, kind of get towards that medical application.
Finally.
Yeah.
Finally I got it.
And so this is great background. I was reading one of your papers, like I mentioned, with Dr. Mahajan, and the math was spectacular, to say briefly. So the background in theoretical physics makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So what specifically is your research on now? I mean, it applies to human vision, but kind of what do you do with that?
We have in this moment several lines of action. So one of them is wavefront coding. We can speak later about it.
Yeah.
But wavefront coding we are using in two lines. One is using in ophthalmoscopes or eye fundus cameras in order to see details in retina without adaptive optics.
Mm-hmm.
Without adaptive optics. So this part is like instrumentation.
Mm-hmm.
At the very same time, with a slightly different design of wavefront coding optics, we are using it to design intraocular lenses or contact lenses for presbyopia.
Okay.
For presbyopia. And also we have another line. And the third leg is like image processing for retinal image when there are cataracts.
Okay.
There is cataracts.
Right. So I'm really interested in that, but we should start with wavefront coding and almost even going back before that, just for people not in, you know, visual optics or testing. So my background's in astronomical mirrors and optics. And like you said, you know, for adaptive optics, for people that see these big telescopes, especially from the ground, the atmosphere is really turbulent. And so we do all sorts of things to kind of morph the mirror, and we correct aberrations. But from my perspective, outside of adaptive optics, it's pretty slow. You measure the aberrations and you correct for them in some way. So how does that translate to visual optics? I know the eye is a visual system, but are they like very similar aberrations that we're seeing?
No, they are different.
They're different.
But you mean in the beginning? Yeah. You begin with adaptive optics?
Yeah.
So the principle is the same. In atmosphere, you have your atmospheric turbulence,
right,
the size of eddy or whatever you have, that it's making that the image of star, a planet, whatever you want to look at, it's all the time affected by aberrations,
mm-hmm,
high order aberrations. And of course, the telescope as it's moving and so on.
Right.
But anyway,
like thermal changes and right.
Thermal changes and gravity, whatever. So it's changing, the aberration is changing. So here is where adaptive optics begins.
Yeah.
So it begins with millimeter. The first one, I think,
mm-hmm,
more or less, if you look at the history of adaptive optics, the one who wants to know what satellite is there, or
if
you aim or you don't aim, or looking from up, if you aim or you don't aim.
Yeah.
So they really have something.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a moment that scientists, sooner or later, everybody arrives to some results. So, it's when adaptive optics is discovered.
Okay.
In the beginning, it goes slow,
you know,
because of technology. And because you need a mirror or a system that corrects aberration real time.
Yep.
But real time means that within the change
of
the aberration time. You need a mirror and you need a computer.
Right.
And of course, this is all the mechanics. So years ago, I don't know if it applies now, but when it was the boom of adaptive optics in atmosphere, there was this, if you want precision, accuracy, a fast system and a cheap system, you only can have two.
Right. Okay.
So
I like that.
You only can have two.
Yeah. It's gonna. So you choose which ones you're.
So you choose time or you choose this. Yeah. It depends on what you have. So when astronomers were doing this, then the moment people working in visual optics say, "Hey, the eye is something very similar. The statistics are different,
mm-hmm,
of the changing of aberrations, and aberrations are not the same, but they change in time.
Yeah. Similar concept.
The similar concept change because the eye lens is all the time trying, mm-hmm, to accommodate because of your lungs, you are breathing.
Yeah.
So everything is moving there. And so with time, the aberrations are changing. And if you want to look at tiny details of retina,
for
big details is not important, you know, the retinoscopes are working.
Yeah.
If you want to look photoreceptors or something like that, that's tiny aberrations, they did not allow you to
see it.
To see it just correcting astigmatism.
So why would I want to see those details?
The photoreceptors, because of two reasons. First, the photoreceptors, they are the pixels of your eye. So, and knowing how they work, so you can get better things in this
goggle.
Of course, correcting a lot of things, like thinking pilots, like thinking people who is focusing and they want to know tiny details.
Yeah.
If you are able to correct that aberrations, in principle, you could get, let's say, supervision.
So that was
in the beginning, more or less, the idea. But also to study all the photoreceptors, that they are part of brain. It's not eye, it's brain.
Right.
So, and see how the connection, how they react to color, a lot of things. But it was difficult to reach that part of retina, or several layers of retina. And here is where adaptive optics arrive. And the first laboratory they got it, it was in Rochester with Professor Williams.
Okay. Yeah.
So they did it. And it was a like this table. It was huge.
Yeah.
And the big computers, you know, with the big bottom.
Right. Yeah.
And everything.
Just what you want to sit in, just what you want to put your eye in front of, right?
Yeah. And, you know, you have to be with the open eye down, fighting not to move well. But anyway,
it works. Yeah.
And now there are adaptive optics, retinoscope, smaller compact, they can study this kind of thing. So this is more or less how different fields they are connected. And this is more or less the idea of adaptive optics. Now the computers are quite fast and quite cheap.
Right. So now you can have all three.
Practically all three. Yeah.
So you mentioned wavefront coding at the beginning, and this is a term, again, I come from astronomical telescopes and metrology, and maybe I was just a bad student, but I was not familiar with this term. So what does it entail?
Wavefront coding, it's a very interesting technique. Because, you know, in optics, what you don't want is aberrations. You don't want aberration in your optics. You don't want aberration in your eye. You don't want aberration in your atmosphere.
Right.
So aberrations are a problem. And again, the first ones were the military.
Yeah.
So when you have a missile, and the missile is running, wherever the missile goes, it has some optics to aim. But the missile goes very fast and it hits, it gets hot.
And shakes, right?
And shakes, but shaking is not that problem. The problem is mainly the dilation. The dilation of the different parts of the optical system. First, the optical system has to be cheap because it's going to be destroyed with the missile or whatever it is. But the other thing is that if the components, I mean, the lenses, the holders, they cannot be made in the same material. So they have different materials. Of course, they choose the proper materials. It's material science.
Right.
They are everywhere.
Right.
But
nonetheless, it'll deform.
The dilation is different. Yeah. So what happened that at the very end, your lens becomes, so I don't remember if myopic or hyperopic, but some defocus problem.
Yeah, yeah.
So they don't see well.
Which is not good, especially for a missile.
So what's wavefront coding doing? That's a beautiful thing, because it's, you have to put a lot of aberrations in the system. Just the opposite, you think.
Mm-hmm.
If you put aberrations in the system, not any aberration, it has specific aberration, but you put a lot. So it's not half a wavelength. I mean, it's maybe 10 wavelengths or something like big aberrations. But what you get with these aberrations is that the PSF, the point spread fraction, or the MTF. Let's go to the MTF because it's the same. It's a Fourier transform. The MTF, it's invariant under the focus
first,
and second, if the aberrations you put in the system make the MTF not having zeros, it means you can divide by it.
Right.
If you can divide, you can get the image.
Yeah.
Because the PSF is going to be independent, or where, I mean, if this is your recording plane, it doesn't matter
where
the image around the plane is going to be focused.
Right.
So the only thing you have to do is the convolution. But the convolution depends on that aberrations.
So
the matrix for the deconvolution and a given application, it's always the same. So it's a story in the system. The system does not have to calculate it.
Yeah.
So it's just a division of numbers that can be very fast.
Huh.
And so it's a hybrid process. So you have the optics and you have the computing thing, but it can be in chip.
Yeah.
So this is the important thing of aberrations, that you say, oh, aberrations, that's awful. But at the very end, in some applications, they are not so awful. And this is what happened in wavefront coding, that you can revert the problem. So you put, what they call the intermediate image, that is the image with the focus plus this aberration, it's awful. I mean, it's very blurry, but there's going to be a deconvolution process.
Do you put that anywhere?
Hmm?
Do you put that intermediate image anywhere? Or does
you
it
put in the exit pupil?
Exit pupil.
This aberration is a plate.
Yeah. Okay.
Or even you can simplify the system by shaping your lens with this aberration.
Sure, okay.
Lenses, several of your lenses, depends on the system. Yeah.
But you're introducing that aberrated wavefront on top of your...
Yeah, okay. On top. Okay. So you design your...
Yeah, yeah. And it's a fixed thing.
And it's?
It's fixed. So you're saying this, it's like a physical thing that you're putting in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Physical thing.
Okay.
It's a physical thing that you can, I can tell you, you can shape in your lens.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's just like adding surfaces. It's like the sum of both surfaces. So you put in your lens, you can put in your holder, but if the lens is shrunk by the optics, or doesn't matter. I mean, it's going to defocus the system, but it's going to be post-processed.
Right, right, right.
And you can do it in real time, so real time that it can go in a missile. And then it had a lot of applications. It had a lot of applications in many, many... for instance, iris detection. You know, when you want to detect the details of iris for eye recognition, that's important because you don't have to say the person who put the eyes just exactly in that place, so you can be a little bit more relaxed here, there. So that's one of the applications. Another application is for surveillance cameras, so you don't have to tell the thief, okay, come here, I want to recognize your face.
Because you're invariant to that.
It's giving you a big depth of field.
Okay, okay.
Without reducing the aperture.
Right, right.
So that's the thing.
So what aberrations do you use? Because, you know, when I first heard about it, the first thing that jumped to mind, or you said, use defocus, and maybe, like, you know, if I thought about it, I'd say some Zernike terms. Mm-hmm. And of course, you would choose the right ones. But you guys did something really cool with the Jacobi Fourier mask.
Yeah.
So can you just kind of explain what terms and kind of why Jacobi Fourier?
The first, let's say, plate or mask, we call mask, also with aberrations, that Dosky and Cathy, we have to say who did
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So that they introduce, it's a cubic. X cube plus Y cube.
Okay.
So it's going to provide a PSF, like L shape.
Yeah.
Invariant.
Yeah.
L shaped and not zeros. And this is the first. And you cannot play much more.
Yeah.
Much more around the cubic.
Right. Right.
So
when was this, by the way? Sorry.
You got me, I think, 70s.
So a bit ago, though.
Yeah, it's a bit ago.
Okay. I can look up the paper and kind of...
Yeah.
And I'll put it in the notes.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I love that idea in optics that there's a lot of things
not 70s, maybe 80s.
70s, 80s. Sure. Yeah. There's a lot of things, though, that the original thing was like a while back, and you know, we're still perfecting it, which I don't know, I always kind of enjoy. But anyway, so sorry, I interrupted
you. I think there is a cycle in things. Yeah. Sometimes some things look that make a freeform shape in a transparent plate, whatever the material is not easy.
Right, right.
It's
right.
Not easy. And it can be very expensive. So sometimes something is forgotten there, with some specific applications that it's working, but maybe it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But the era of plastics arrive, and the era of freeform in many different ways of fabrication arrive, that they make, that you can ask a company, do this, and you give a formula, they do it.
For you,
not very expensive.
Yeah,
not
comparatively.
So it away from coding, it come back again. Come back again. But it's the same with Harman.
Yeah.
The idea of Harman, I don't know if you remember the first Harman, not Chuck Harman.
Right,
the
right,
first
right.
Harman screen, that it was like a huge tape, round wood with holes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just big holes.
Big holes, then the projection where you,
you
put your pencil.
Yeah.
So then Professor Chuck, that's from this university, he put the lenses.
Yeah.
You know, and then you wanted to make it smaller.
Right.
And then micro lenses appear. But micro lenses they appear because optical communications needed tiny lenses. Yeah. So because of optical communication, the Shack-Hartmann.
Different areas are kind of.
So yeah. It's like everything is related.
Yeah.
Like that. So I lost.
I distracted, but so they originally used the cubic function.
The cubic function works very well, but in the image you can observe some artifacts. There are artifacts, and it has some, depending on the peak to valley of the aberration, you can have more or less. More or less depth of field.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The biggest the depth of field, you have to be careful with the signal to noise ratio, because you get an invariant MTF.
Yeah.
Invariant MTF, but invariant you get because it drops very fast.
Yeah.
And you say it drops. What happened? Nothing, because you are going to post process it. But when it is in the tail.
Yeah, you're not
close
getting
to the exit, right. Depending where the noise is.
Okay.
So, this was the original one. The next one that reduces artifacts is what is known in literature for Zernike polynomials, like the trefoil or trefoil.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it's a cubic too.
Okay.
It's a cubic, but it goes three times.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Three times. So the PSF is not going to be just like this. It's going to be like a spike, you know, like a spike, but then you are going to have like the three legs.
And we have, I have your paper.
Oh yeah.
And I'll be sure to put these pictures up in the video so people can see them and reference the paper. But yeah, it's kind of, I don't know how to draw it, but yeah, kind of three spikes coming up.
Three spikes, something like that. The face is easy. The face is easy. Three mountains and three valleys.
Yeah, right.
So
okay.
that's why the trefoil.
Yeah.
And this one, just only having this symmetry that goes in, say, in radial or polar coordinates with cosine of three times the angle.
Yeah.
With cosine three times the angle, the artifacts are minimized.
Mm-hmm.
Are minimized. And then you have the R cube. Term.
Yeah.
So we work it with that sometime, and we make simulations, and even we have some of them implemented for looking at the retina, and it works. But we say, okay, let's try to improve it a little bit because of the signal to noise ratio. So what we were working was with the power, and then with the power, the polynomial, the Jacobi polynomials appear.
Yeah.
So it's changed a little bit the power. So make it. Not one by one.
Yeah.
Make it a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
So it can be 1.3 instead of 3.5. That is some Jacobi polynomials goes in half.
Yeah.
In halves. So with that, we make all the study and we realize that depending on the power, I mean, there is a sort of compromise.
Yeah.
So it's a balance. Noise, accuracy, depth of field, what you want. But depending on the application, you can get better results that just going up with the power, but keeping
the same
angular dependence.
Huh, okay.
If you put two times theta, that's astigmatism.
Mm-hmm.
And astigmatism goes from one focal line to other focal line. So there is not really invariance.
Yeah.
You can use maybe 4 theta or you can use 5 theta. That's also okay. It goes many times. So you have to... But the trefoil or 4 theta works very well. When the moment you have many, many loops, you lose.
You do. It declines.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is something. I mean, cosine of 3 theta is kind of star PSF is much more similar to something with rotational symmetry than an L.
Yeah. Right.
So that's why it's working a little bit better.
Hmm. And so the Jacobi Fourier mask that you use. Mm-hmm. It has, in particular, like application to visual optics.
Mm-hmm.
What's the application that benefits more from that? I guess what is that trade off?
Okay, so now we go in two lines.
Yeah.
The first line is that we are developing is in eye fundus cameras.
Uh-huh.
Okay, when you're going to go to detail, what I told you, there are aberrations not only the focus.
Yeah.
but people has astigmatism, and people has high order aberrations.
Yeah.
High order aberrations. So the first thing we realize is that the wavefront coding, even with the trefoil or the cubic, pure cubic lens, it works also, it's invariant for astigmatism. It was designed at the beginning for the focus, but it also
works for astigmatism.
So, it works with astigmatism. So it means that you are going to have two elements, legs, to correct your... And for a camera, for an ophthalmoscope, that you don't need to use the wheel.
If you
put in a smartphone. So that's our idea too.
So when you're saying, like, when they switch out, is A better B? You could just put the phone.
Yeah, yeah. So you can use a portable ophthalmoscope. That's our main research line now, a portable an ophthalmoscope. And we want to put a telephone or a smartphone with an app.
Yeah.
And of course, instead of putting your arm, you just put the telephone.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same. At the very end, this is the same. But you know, ophthalmoscopes, they have a wheel where you correct for the focus of both.
Yeah.
The practitioner
and the patient. User. Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So here you don't need the practitioner because you have your smartphone, but you have the patient.
And are you, in the thing that you're projecting on the phone, you're adding those aberrations into it?
We are adding at the exit lens the smartphone.
Right, okay.
This plate.
Oh, that's great.
This plate. That is a plate. I mean, it's nothing very complicated. So you just glue it and try to center a little bit.
Yeah.
So you put it there, and then you put the smartphone, and then you have to do it in the smartphone. Now we are doing the computer, but we're trying to develop the app. And so you don't need to correct for astigmatism and all these kind of things. And if you have a retinoscope or iPhone-less camera with higher magnification, where the other aberrations, the higher order aberrations are going to be important. And if you want to see details in the retina, then these aberrations have to be corrected.
Right.
And this is why people is using Shack-Hartmann sensors with all the deformable mirrors. But they are quite expensive, much more than a computer. So that's what the other thing we are doing for making details, for observing details in retina. And that's not with a smartphone. That's with a...
Like the proper computer.
With a computer or something that you can adapt to a retinoscope and you are watching the screen, but the computer is making the real-time processing.
Is the real-time processing, what is that driving? Is that like driving like a, what is it analyzing? Let me phrase it like that. Sorry.
What is that?
So is the computer analyzing the output from the retinoscope?
Yeah, the computer deconvolves a very blurry image because...
Which is using that Jacobi Fourier mask. Yeah. Okay.
That's the Jacobi polynomial.
Okay,
so,
okay.
We can get smaller depending... Yeah, Jacobi we use depending on the noise and everything, but we are trying to refine the design in order to put it in the eye. And it will not correct, because it does not correct.
Right.
But the MTF will be invariant to the focus, astigmatism, and high order aberrations.
Okay, okay.
So the MTF is invariant.
Yeah.
So in your computer, the only thing you need to have is a matrix.
Mm-hmm. Which can be done fast.
It's in your computer. Yeah, you don't need to calculate every time.
Right.
You don't need a deformable mirror and all the mechanics to changing and the communication between the computer and the mirror and everything. So that would be just something very simple that later can be in a very cheap. Now we are using computers.
Right.
But that's the idea. And we got some image, not yet to photoreceptors, but we got image of the what is called the corocapillar, that is the when you see the retina, usually the retinographs, the iPhones, you see, you know, the optical disc and the
right.
But if you go to bigger magnification, there is a mesh of very tiny vessels. That's called corocapillars. And the aberrations are important because with aberrations, you cannot see them. So we were able to detect them.
So is it like a mesh of capillary blood vessels?
It's a mesh. And depending, well, when you have a mesh, you have holes.
Yeah.
So depending on the density, for instance, of holes,
just a very simple
pathology. Depending, it needs to have a given density of holes.
Yeah.
Because if you have a lot, you have a neovascularization. A lot of vessels are being born.
Yeah.
You don't want that.
Yeah.
And if there are a few, that means that they are
dying off,
dry, or dying. Or because of
some reason,
diabetes or whatever it is. So that's not my field. So
right. Yeah.
So by counting, then you, what they do, they have some programs to count this kind of thing. So another stuff. So if they are little, like little balls, you can see like little balls means they are aneurysm.
So the shape as well.
Density, shape, distribution, where the holes are, because the density is not uniform along the retina or the macula or near the optical disc. So depending where you are, you have a lot of properties, but they are studied. But just analyzing that, you can. So we went a layer inside the eye with this wavefront coding. We have image of that.
So, and going forward, it seems the next thing that you're working on is basically you don't even need a computer. You can put it on a chip to make it kind of smaller.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming as well that as you further optimize this, like you said, you can go a step deeper. You're not imaging the mesh. You're imaging single photoreceptors or something of that nature.
That's where we are.
Okay.
So that's one leg of the way from coding.
Yeah.
And then there is another leg. The other leg is, what if I make a contact lens or an intraocular lens? Everybody makes intraocular lens, usually with rotational symmetry.
Okay. With rotational symmetry.
With rotational symmetry. That is more or less what the crystalline lens with the eye lens has.
Yeah.
More or less.
Right.
And so they want to create depth of field. So that's the idea. When you lose the ability of your eye lens to stretch and accommodate to see in the distance or to read, when you lose that, you know, it's when the arms becomes to be smaller So when these things happen, this is one problem. This is presbyopia.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, a little bit later, you get cataract. So sooner or later, you get the surgery. So there are a lot of designs, zillions of designs of the lenses after you take the lens that you put inside. And so you correct the cataract and you give some depth of field to the person. That's all they can drive.
Because the implanted intraocular lens can't accommodate.
They can accommodate. There were some attempts to make accommodative.
But generally, it's not going to be like your crystalline lens.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. So the thing is, if it there is, you cannot do this, something that is changing processing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm looking far away, I process, I change the shape,
I'm
reading here, or I'm looking at in the intermediate distance. So what they do is put some aberrations.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we go to aberrations in the lenses to create the depth of field.
Okay.
So there are very many. One easy aberration, you know, is spherical aberration.
Yeah.
A spherical aberration can give you some depth of field. So some designs are based in spherical aberration. Some of them, they make different zones.
Mm-hmm.
So different, like zonal.
Yeah.
And so that just like three focal or bifocal. So more or less this three focality or two focality at the very end is like a sort of invariant.
Sure.
PSF in the middle. And of course you are going to have halos.
Mm.
And the contrast decrease.
Okay.
Always.
Yeah.
Always. But after having cataracts, you are not that picky.
Yeah.
And people does not realize. And there is a lot of eyes that they process.
Right.
So
the patient's going from it's really hard to see too. Oh, yeah. It's an improvement period.
Yeah, it's an improvement. Yeah. And also there, remember that the retina is part of the brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the retina or the brain can process.
Yeah.
So that's why we thought, what about not making symmetric the lenses and design lenses with more or less the idea of wavefront coding, of course, adapted
with the
proper Jacobi polynomial, with the proper angular and radial dependence for an eye is different than another application. And what happened? So first we made simulations, and the simulation seems that the eye has what is called a neural function, a neural filter, and the neural filter is able to process. So at the very end, it's making the convolution, if not completely,
close enough. And do you see that the patient adapts to this, let me ask it differently? Is there a period of adaptation, or do you implant it and they open their eye and they're good?
Well, so I'm going to tell you something. This is not my words. These are a colleague of mine, okay, that I make myself in this very moment. But the thing is, any lens you put in the eye, the moment you have to remove the eye lens because of whatever, because you have cataracts or break or whatever, you put it there, it's correcting. I mean, you can give some depth for presbyopia, and at the same time, usually they correct the astigmatism, they correct even if you are myopic or hyperopic. So they correct that, okay? So they put the lens inside. Also, let's suppose that nothing happens to your lens, but for whatever reason, you are myopic or you are hyperopic, you have astigmatism. So you use the contact lenses.
Yeah.
So you know that people do not adapt to contact lenses. So they are trying different kind of things.
Yeah.
All this kind, and the prescription is the same, because you can, it's not a matter I put more prescription or less prescription. No, the prescription, it's what it is, but the way that they correct and everything. So some people, they do not adapt. So the question is, why they do adapt to the intraocular lenses quite well, and they do not adapt to the contact lenses, or it takes time to adapt to the contact lenses? Because they cannot take it out.
They don't have an option.
So you don't have any other option. Or you adapt.
Yeah.
What happened? There are persons that they are very picky. The eye is very picky.
Yeah.
And they, even with the intraocular lens or the contact lens, they detect very tiny. For instance, you just miss a little bit of 0.12 in the focus, diopters in the focus, and they do not adapt. They feel it. They are not able to process. So depending on the picky you are going, if you're not very picky, you're going to see well, you're going to see details, you're going to go, you're going to drive, you're going to read.
Yeah, it's fine. It's
and
no
that
problem.
Depends on how your eye and your brain process the things. But of course, if you cannot take it out, sooner or later, you have to adapt it.
Yeah.
You know that people who works in optics, you work in optics. So when you have these telephones and you look at a selfie, I say, oh my God, don't put me in the corner because the spherical aberration might make my face a little bit bigger or whatever. Most of people don't realize.
Yeah.
Don't realize. So, and sometimes you can see chromatic in some lenses or and it's because you are used to.
Yeah.
And in the moment you are used to and you know what happened, and that depends also in usual life. Some persons are very picky what they see.
Yeah.
But if, in the center of the Gaussian, sooner or later they arrive.
Yeah,
and
they
it's
adapt.
Very fast.
You know, it reminds me of kind of the early endeavors towards LASIK surgery when they did the I always forget it. Sorry, I shouldn't have said it.
I know what you're speaking about.
Keratometry?
I know in Spanish, now I cannot say in English.
What's it in Spanish?
Keratometría radial, no?
Yeah, so radial keratometry.
Yeah. Something like that.
But for people listening, you know, they would make an incision and make radial scars on your eye. Some people liked it because it kept proceeding and eventually it led to developing LASIK. But you have to imagine, like you were saying earlier, you get huge, you know, blooms of straight light and diffraction and you adapt, I guess. So.
Adapt. That finally the brain discard everything.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I mean, if you work in optics or you are very picky, I mean, with everybody in my laboratory that certain age that we have to change our lenses in the night, especially in the night, for us is a nightmare because we see chromatic, we see the spherical aberration, we detect the spherical aberration and we are not happy with it. During the day is okay, but during the night you have a big pupil, so all these defects appear. Even for me, in my case, I can see the rim of the lens.
Really
And I, not always.
Yeah.
So sometimes I, you know, it's like something happens. Here it is.
Yeah.
So, and everybody who, I remember a student of us, a PhD student, that he had a problem with a contact lens.
Mm-hmm.
He came and say, in the night, when there are lights there, I see fringes. Instead, I see deaf people say, I see fringes. And fringes. So they make the topography for the contact lens. He was using contact lens. Nothing was visible. And then we make interferometry of the of the lens. And there was a very, very tiny bubble. So tiny that you cannot see the bubble. But it creates diffraction.
And
because of diffraction, some sort of interference. So, and he knew where it was. So it must be something here, you know, that he had astigmatism, so it's marked. So we look there and it was a very tiny bubble, not visible, of course, not in topography, but not even with the Chuck Harman, where they measure, no, because it's a bubble. So they couldn't see. And interferometry, you know, these tiny defects pop up and say, here is your bubble. But it was a bubble of
less
than a fraction of microns. We were used to see fringes. So you see fringes everywhere. So this is the thing. But for average, so all the things are made for the average, for the center of the Gaussian, for the 90% of the persons. They get used to it.
So the application of wavefront coding in the topic we just covered, you can make an interocular lens that's not rotationally symmetric, and it provides you better depth of focus. Is there any other benefit?
The benefit is that it's very, it has a lot of tolerance to manufacturing, so you can confuse a little bit. Because it's going to give you still the depth of focus to tilts.
Okay.
So we were in the process of all these simulations, but it works. Not for a lens.
Right.
Not for
a lens. It has to be the interocular lens. Right.
It has to be intraocular or even maybe contact. We don't know what's going to happen with the small rotations. In the moment the PSF is there, the brain is saying, okay, this is my PSF, I'm going to process it. So I'm going to deconvolve somehow. If the PSF is changing,
how fast is that?
For intraocular, it's working. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that we had a plate. I think Jim Zwieberlin, Professor Zwieberlin, made it for us. And we were using the idea of making for the eye was this kind of serendipity, you know? We were focusing in instrumentation. So with this...
Was it an Alvarez lens? Hmm? Was it an Alvarez lens?
No, it was a trifoil.
Okay.
It was a trifoil lens. Okay. He made it here.
Okay.
So that's why we were working together in these designs. So he made a trifoil for the retinoscope. And I had it in my desk. You know? And in a moment, I was very myopic at that time. Now I have the lenses, but the intraocular lens. But at that time, I was very myopic a couple of years ago. And, you know, I took it, removed my glasses. With my glasses, I cannot see till position. And I put it like this.
Yeah.
And say, oh, my God, I'm looking in the distance. And then I look like that. Of course, you have to.
Yeah,
to
move right.
Because,
right.
You know, but it, and,
Yeah.
It was like moving. But I said, and I can read. And it was not specifically designed. It was the very first time, and I am very picky.
Yeah.
But you know what I say, I can't. I mean, if you move it, you lose it. But in the moment it's centered, you do just like this. Say, my God, it's working.
It works.
It works.
So that was how, that was the motivation.
That was the serendipity, you know, that all your life take you to this, to that line that we are exploding now, because we were in instrumentation.
Right.
And image processing, and also some part with wavefront sensing.
Yeah, this kind of.
So that was the beginnings.
Huh. And so what are the next steps for your research? I guess kind of where are you at?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we are in the process of patent the lens and then the fight with some company that wants to buy the patent. This is for the intraocular lens.
Yeah.
For the image processing with cataracts, we are pretty advanced. So we have now, let's say it's an old software for improvement, but now we have a better one. Improvement of software for looking at retina when you have cataracts. I think in general it will be online.
The software.
Online free, I mean you download it and you install in your computer. The executable. Executable.
Yeah,
the executable program. But we want to do it online.
Mm-hmm.
In such a way that if you have a Wi-Fi, you can use your Apple tablet or your phone or whatever you are not.
So it's not just Windows or whatever.
Just not Windows or whatever. So this is the second thing with these cataracts. And the third one is to implement it in the smartphones that they are being coupled to a handheld, to a hand ophthalmoscopes.
Mm.
And do the app in such a way that it will process in real time. The convolution is done in real time. Because first it's going, sometimes when there are cataracts, they cannot find a disc.
Mm-hmm.
There is no focusing. With cataracts, there is no, in fact, there is a depth field. But you can focus a little better. You can go to the disc.
You're saying when you're observing the retina. The outside observer looking at the retina. Okay.
Yeah, or if you do it with normal optics, then you take the photograph. Now it's only from the pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so you put it in the computer and process and give you the, you have to choose a couple of parameters. And just in order to tell you how things are interconnected, we are using a kernel based in the atmospheric kernel for fog. Or rain, or these kind of things that it's
similar.
Related with what we did when we were working in atmospheric optics, that for making the convolution of the image of the blur, that is because of fog, not because of the aberration, but because of fog. So instead of the freed radius, you have any other things, you have a density function of the cataract or whatever, the accumulation of things or the scratches your cornea has. So everything itself,
ties together. So okay, so let me try to summarize this, and I'm going to partly describe kind of what it looks like when I go to the eye doctor, and hopefully you can tell me how that might change, and maybe not for me, but for other people in particular. But from what you've described, you know, typically I go to the eye doctor. I am a glaucoma suspect, so I have the big imaging device, and they look at the cupping and they look at the vascularization, mm-hmm. and the eye doctor spends a long time looking at it, and you really have to get your eye position just right, mm-hmm. and you have to push just right, mm-hmm. And then they check your vision, and the doctor spends some time, and they're looking through this device and A or B, P or A, and at the end of it, you know, I'll get a new pair of glasses or a new pair of contacts, and they'll work pretty well. And eventually when I'm 40 or 50, especially in Tucson in the desert, 50, I'm going to get cataracts. I won't be able to, my interocular lens won't be able to adapt. I won't be able to focus at a wide
presbyopia.
Yeah. And at much less, I'm going to get cataracts and it'll get milky and I'll have a hard time seeing. But that's okay because I'll get surgery and, you know, I can go to the eye doctor anyways, and they'll be careful and see what's wrong with my eye, and I'll get surgery and get a new intraocular lens. So just, and I mean, I can think of this, I can think of so many applications, but it sounds like what you were saying is with wavefront coding, one of the applications, one of the first things is you don't need the eye doctor on the other side looking through this, correcting for themselves. It, you know, the wavefront coding allows for more accurate imaging of finer details of the eye. In terms of, in some applications, in terms of an intraocular lens, you might be able to provide something with greater depth of field. And I'm really interested with the cell phone application because that sounds small and easy to carry. That's different from these big devices, right? So,
I mean, for details, you need, so far you need a big.
Definitely.
Because you need the magnification to look at the details. But look at the, usually iPhones. You are telling me that your initial glaucoma or something. Glaucoma is affecting your retina.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to see how the vessels are behaving or they are developing drops. They give you the medicines you are using for that. So you need to do that. In order to see these vessels, you don't need a...
It's not super resolution.
No, you don't need a big thing. So with this handy retinoscope, you can see quite well. And so what happens if you begin with cataracts? Begin with cataracts and they don't see well your retina. There's a moment they don't see well your retina. If the cataract advances quite fast, or because of something happening in your eye and you cannot see through fog. Forgetting aesthetical things, because you know it's a milky thing there, but forgetting the aesthetical part, what happened if you became blind in your retina because your blood vessels are very affected by glaucoma or whatever thing you have? What is the, to put in risk, every surgery has a little bit of risk, so you put a lens and finally you are not going to see. So this is one of the applications. Here in the first world, it doesn't matter, but in the third world, it's very important because you probably are going to be every 6 months or you're not going to get cataracts or they are going to tell you we go right now.
Yeah.
But in
You're just starting to get a cataract, we'll get you in. Yeah.
So in other places, you don't know how the retina is because people has cataracts from time. So... we can get some details. Depends on the cataract, of course, you know, they go from mild to severe to hyper severe. But in some cases, if you can look at some vessels, the shape of the big vessels, not the tiny ones, the big vessels, knowing the shape, if you can see more or less how they enter into this, you know if that person is going to be blind or not, independent of if you put that. So that's our idea, to make something cheap, portable, that everybody can use. An ophthalmologist, they can see through fog.
They really
can see because they are very trained persons. But maybe in a, I don't know how to say in English, but you know, if you have a medical center where there is a practitioner that he knows a little bit of everything, but he's not an ophthalmologist through cataracts. Maybe he is not able to see details in that vessels or whatever happened in the retina, that they are related with some diseases, even like diabetes is detected before in the eye than in the blood, or something is happening in the eye, and so maybe it cannot detect the microaneurysm or whatever happened there, or distinguish if it is this pathology or this pathology. With this thing, the image will be clear. This image processing will be clear. This is with the image processing in the
device.
On the other hand, with wavefront coding, you can get good image with a small, ophthalmoscope without using mobile parts, can be very cheap, very robust, that you can take anywhere.
Yeah.
The mobile phone is the thing that if you are connected to Wi-Fi, you can send the image to.
Right.
To
have processing or analyzation.
If you get an image, you can send it
somewhere.
So more or less, we are to this robust small device, chip that they can give you information for cataracts.
Yeah.
Correcting, well, cataracts is one thing, but with all this image processing.
Yeah.
The idea, the final idea is in a moment we get a good, with wavefront coding for small details or for cataracts, if you are able to process the image and then apply an algorithm of artificial intelligence for detection. So it is a step.
Yeah,
that you give the pre-processed image. The image has already some good contrast to for image processing, looking for aneurysm or this kind of, I don't know, drusen or whatever happened there. It will look, it will find,
right,
but not with cataracts. So this is is our goal long term.
To get kind of provide clean data, I guess, so to speak. So.
And related with the intraocular lenses.
Yeah.
The intraocular lenses, that it will be, let's say, quite universal. There is now this thing of customized lenses.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is just the opposite. It's completely uncustomized.
Right.
It can be used for, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter you're astigmatist or you maybe even you were a great myopic person. That's okay. But within the normal Gaussian defects they have, so that you only need to fabricate one lens. So this is what we are
trying.
Huh. Even for dogs.
For dogs?
Dogs, yeah. Well, now dogs are getting cataract surgery.
Really?
Really, dogs and cats, of course.
And
they are not as much picky as we are.
Right.
As we are. So you don't need to, you know, big dog something and a small dog has, not much difference, but they can have defects. And then the only thing is they get cataracts, you take it and you put one lens, that it will be good for most of them.
Wow.
And they will see in the distance and
close. So just to kind of turn course a little bit, we're getting close to taking up the full hour and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but for somebody that's not in the field that's considering it, why should they go into visual optics? You have me convinced, but what's your kind of sure reason for why visual optics and medical applications specifically, I guess, why is that so compelling?
Well, I think visual optics is a application that you get very satisfying results. A person that cannot see anything or hardly see, and you get some improvement. I'm not even saying that some improvement that's important.
Yeah.
I'm speaking about the intraocular lenses, for instance,
or
contact lenses, if you have any defect. What happened? I mean, if you are in a country where you have not access, photoreceptors are important so far to understand how vision is working. This is developing research. But for instance, all these corocapillars, you need OCTs. We can get some image very close to not what OCT make a lot of things, okay? But some output of the OCT, we can get that.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to give a very good information how the vascularization in retina is doing, and it can give a diagnostic, not only what's going to happen with your vision, but maybe related to
other components
issues,
other
components. So I think that any kind of optics that goes through health.
Yeah.
The output is health application in health. For me, I think it's very important.
Yeah.
And I like that. And you see the results.
Yeah.
Making a very cheap ophthalmoscope that you go to small city.
Yeah.
With not much experience in ophthalmology, you take some photographs that they are very difficult if you have some cataracts, but you take, you measure, and you send it.
Yeah.
Artificial intelligence just give you a percentage of that's going to happen with these persons.
Yeah.
I think it's important. If you can put lenses to these persons that you don't need to customize because they don't have money, they don't have all this, they measure all this kind of sophisticated thing. That is beautiful optics.
Right.
It's beautiful optics too. So it's
different it's helping a different area, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a lot of locations where people, the absolute best that you might get in some of these areas is, here's discarded eyeglasses.
Yeah.
I hope it helps a little bit, mm-hmm. right? So if you could replace that with, here's a thing, it'll help a bunch.
Yeah.
Is enormous. I think that's amazing. There's one other question I want to ask you. Particularly going through really any of your papers, but especially that paper with Dr. Mahajan, why should we spend more time learning math?
Oh.
I know that's out of left field, so I apologize.
No. I tell you because the subject I teach in my faculty is mathematics.
Oh, is it?
Is it? Oh. I mean, I give the master courses in optics. But in the graduate students, it's physics. I'm teaching in physics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm teaching math, and now I'm teaching differential equations. And some years ago, I was teaching topology.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
So it's very abstract.
Yeah.
Very abstract math. So math, for two reasons. The first reason that why everybody should study math from they are very small. To, of course, if you want to be a researcher or whatever you want to be in life.
Yeah.
The first is logic. Even if the maths are good for nothing, good for nothing, I am sure that the maths you study, the people that study in the school, maybe they are not going to need it.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of, I mean, the second degree equation, when are they going to be in the real life solving a second degree equation,
right,
that
right,
is
right.
nothing. But the way of thinking, the way what represents geometrically, the logic mm-hmm. in mathematics, it really changes your brain, the way of thinking. You become more logical.
Yeah.
So A implies B.
Right.
B does not imply A.
Right.
So that's important. Theorem, demonstration, that's a very beautiful, forget the applications in physics, in any field. So just the beauty of a language of mathematics mm-hmm. that is able to solve a problem, the way of solving the problem is as much important as the solution.
Right.
Something so simple in mathematics that I tell to my students, sometimes I give you a problem, real life, okay? Don't go directly to the problem. First, think a little bit.
Yeah.
Because there is no solution, first, maybe it's better to check if there is no solution before
spending time
looking theories, different approaches, and whatever. So for me, that's one of the things. Second, mathematics is the language of physics
mm-hmm.
in any field, not optics. Any field of physics is the language. If you don't know how to speak physics, you don't know physics.
Right.
So you can speak in a TV program and speak these persons that for me, I mean, they amaze me because they are able to speak of super strings and optics. And this and that. So my idea is whatever say, do you know how to solve a differential equation just to know that the planets go in a given
right.
elliptic shape, trajectory,
right.
first approach. So you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's important thing for me, that the way we have to communicate with everything is mathematics.
This
is the mathematics.
I do think it took me past differential equations to have that moment of seeing that interweaving, seeing that of like, you know, here's the phenomenon we're seeing, or like diffraction. Here's the phenomenon we're seeing. By the way, here's the math. And it's just, it's perfect. And you once you kind of clue into that, it's like, oh my God, you know, like you start to appreciate, like you're saying, math is the language of physics, and it's wonderful. But I do think recently, within the past couple of years, I started to, just for fun, look more at math stuff, and there's so many like great resources. There's like YouTube now, and there's, mm-hmm. there's a website, Libre Math, which has like free math textbooks mm-hmm. and things. I don't know what the difference is, but it's so much easier and more fun now than when you're a student.
Yeah.
When you're a student, you're thinking like, you know, it's a differential equation, and you know, do I have to consider this, or like, what, you know, what about boundary conditions? And it feels stressful. And I don't know, when you're past it, it's like, this is amazing.
But look at something that for me was, I mean, if just you look at this history of science, people began to count with the fingers, you know, or like Sumerians, that they cut these little bones.
Right.
So that's why there is a system of 12x or 6x, and other person's 5x or 10x, depending on the culture. So this kind of thing. So you begin counting, okay? If counting it's okay for you till 10 or whatever, that's enough. You can live with that. Mm. There are cultures that they have 1, 2, 3, 4, many.
Because they have
a few things.
Yeah.
They have only 2 chicken or 1 goat.
Right.
Or so they're not many. I mean, 3 chicken and 4 chicken are many. They have no difference. Even if you have 5 is still many.
Yeah.
So you don't need more maths.
Right.
And if they live in common, they don't need to divide, or they don't need to have negatives. But in the moment you advance a little bit, you need more numbers.
Yeah.
And all this, you know, that's the name. I will say the. It will come to work.
Yeah.
The word, it will come. You know, when you construct the real numbers, so that you, this is not a theorem or a definition. I mean, this is like this.
Yeah.
A real number, it is positive or negative, or it is the same number, but it cannot be three things at the same time.
Right.
The axioms.
The
10 axioms. So
yeah.
The axioms were 9, and finally you need the 10th
in
order to fill the holes between some rational numbers or irrational numbers or these kind of things. But you are constructing these maths as you go far and far and far in technology, and we are in the moon, and we are in Mars, and we can see far away galaxies, and we operate with robots, and now artificial intelligence is going to be there and being helping a lot, interpreting what you have to tell them mathematically.
Right. Yeah.
So this is, for me, this is very beautiful, the evolution. So I think that in the school, when we have to teach this, the students, I mean, you can make it beautiful, but there is some part that they say, forget if it's beautiful or not. That way of reasoning is going to help you the rest of your life.
Yeah.
The rest of your life. If you don't know what's a rational number or an irrational number, it does not matter.
Yeah.
It does not matter. But thinking how the process is a very beautiful, I mean, it's evolution somehow.
Yeah,
it's how we are evolving.
Yeah.
So that's the beauty of maths.
Yeah.
It's my point of view.
I mean,
I'm very enthusiastic when I teach mathematics. You
know, well, so. That's...
And what is this inferential good for? I say, I don't care. I don't mind.
Right.
Maybe you will discover when you study quantum mechanics, or maybe you never see this equation again.
Yeah.
But just play with it.
Yeah.
Just play. Try to solve it.
So
it has both things, the application. The physicists, we always have an advantage respect to mathematician, is that we can put a shape or something when you are solving. I mean, you solve a differential equation for a pendulum, and the solution has to be a sine or a cosine or something that at least goes on by. You know. It can be, maybe the period is not okay, or maybe it goes faster or goes slowly. For a mathematician, if you solve their second degree equation, they can get anything that goes here, and then growing. It's difficult for them to know if the solution is okay unless they put it in the equation.
Into an actual,
For us, we have that image, this is this equation, so it has to be within this limit. So we play with some advantage somehow.
Yeah.
But in any of the cases of the pure abstract mathematics, it's the logic you learn, your brain develops a lot.
That's
my point of view.
Yeah.
It's not.
I love that. I don't have any more questions about optics or math or physics. So thank you so much for taking the time
to
talk.
Welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Spotlight Report. As always, we invite you to go to our website, community.eleoptics.com, where you can communicate and discuss this episode of the podcast and find all other episodes of the podcast, as well as other useful information. Thanks. Have a great day.